We're doing Parashat Vayechi, the concluding parsha of the book of Bereishit. We will read about the conclusion of Yaakov's life, Yaakov's final blessings to the tribes, and the tribes are sent to Israel to bury their father, and their return where they plead with Yosef that their father gave a message, he should forgive his brothers and take care of him. They fabricate this one. And Yosef says, you have nothing to worry about. I'm going to take care of you guys. We're all in this together. And ultimately the parsha ends with Yosef making the Jews promise that when they leave Egypt, they take his bones with them, as did the other tribes. And Yosef makes them promise. He tells them, Pakod yifkod elokim etchem. Redeem God shall redeem you. And that code, he's telling them that the redemption will come with the Redeemer who comes and says that dual language, Pakod Yifkod. And every exile had its letter. You know, in Hebrew we have double letters, right? You have a Chaf, and then you have a Chaf at the end of the word. It's different than the regular Chaf. You have a Mem, and a Mem that appears at the end of the word. A Nun, and a Nun that appears at the end of the word. A Pei, and a Pei that appears at the end of the word. So these letters each represent a different nation that we had to escape, a different nation that we were in servitude to. And so the Egyptian nation we overcame, and the redemption was signified by the letter Pei, Pakod Pakadti, whatever that means. Let's start the parasha. Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. Our sages say this is part of the righteousness of Yosef. Yosef had grown up in his father's home for 17 years. His father had funded him. And so ultimately, at the end of his life, Yosef takes care of his father for 17 years. He's coming full circle. Yaakov's life was only complete when he had the whole family together. So he had 17 years in the beginning, until Yosef was 17 years old, and then 17 years in the end. That's a total sum of, what, 17 times plus 17? 34. Very good. And what is the numerical value of the word Vayechi? 34, Vayechi Yaakov. Yaakov lived those 34 years when he had all his children together at the table. So Yaakov lived 147 years, the last 17 years being in Egypt. And as he sensed that his days were nearing, he calls Yosef and he tells him, please take a vow that you will do chesed ve'emet with me. I want you to take me and bury me in Israel. Yaakov calls it chesed ve'emet. And today we call the burial services Gachsha. Gachsha is an acronym. Gmilut Chasadim Shel Emet. Gachsha. Gmilut Chasadim Shel Emet. You'll see that on the vans that carry the deceased. So this concept of Chesed Shel Emet, a kindness of truth, we say that when a person passed away, you know if you're taking care of him, he's not coming back to pay you back in the near future, right? So that's called a kindness of truth, where you have no intention of getting anything back from that person. So Yaakov asks Yosef, I want you to promise me to do a kindness of truth. Do not bury me in Egypt. There are two prongs to this request. Number one, don't bury me in Egypt. There's a problem. The Egyptians will turn me into an idol, and God punishes not only the worshiper, but the thing that was worshipped. There's a problem that the sand of Egypt will turn into the kinim, the lice. There's a problem that those who are buried in Chutz Laaretz have to undergo terrible pain in the resurrection of the dead. Their bodies have to roll to Israel, and from there they will come back to life. I want to be buried in Israel. This is the concept we know till today, that people very often will invest a lot of money to be buried in Israel. If you're a citizen and you're here, you get free burial from the state. Okay, you don't have to pay for that. If you're a citizen and you're here. So I will, what?
Don't want to use that benefit.
Right, that benefits you want to hold off on. So, you carry me from Egypt and bury me with them. Bury me, Yosef promises. Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh Amita. Yaakov bowed towards the head of the bed. The head of the bed is where the Shekhinah is present. Our sages say, whenever a person is ill, the Pasuk says in Psalms, Hashem Yisadenu al Eres Devai. Hashem supports a person even as he is deathly ill. Hashem is there supporting him. And that's why a person doesn't even have to go to minyan. A person who's deathly ill should save his strength in bed. And it's considered even greater than a minyan. The Shekhinah is right there. So Yosef promises. Why does Yaakov make Yosef promise? because the nature of things is that even with the best intentions, sometimes there are extenuating circumstances. And if a person said, I swear by God's honor, I will do it, so then he's forced to do it. And in fact, that's what happens. When Yosef wants to take up Yaakov to be buried in Israel, Pharaoh says, no way, we're not opening the borders. You guys aren't leaving. And this has two views. One understanding is, this is where the Jews started understanding that there was no way out of Egypt in the near future, and that's why our parsha represents the beginning of the servitude to the Egyptians. The Jews understood they're under the Egyptians. They weren't yet doing any hard labor, but the idea that the Egyptians felt they could control them and say, you are not leaving. They needed a special visa, and only on condition that they left their family and cattle and wealth in Israel. So that's our traditional understanding of what happened here, that there was a message here, and that message was heard loud and clear. And that's why our tradition is that whenever we write a parsha in Torah, we leave a gap before the parsha to indicate this is a new segment, not this parsha. When you see the Torah in this week, if you guys are going to Sfardi Shul, where they do Hagbah in the beginning of the reading, so you'll notice that it's hard to notice where our parsha begins, because the sentences go straight. It begins in the middle of a line. You wouldn't even know it's a new parsha. That's to indicate that things started closing in on Israel. Their eyes started getting overshadowed with the oppression of the Egyptian forces. So that's the traditional understanding. There's another understanding that has less of a stress among our sages, but it also appears, and that is that the Egyptians knew that if Yosef leaves, they have to send a whole entourage. There's the danger of an attack. This is the greatest empire. People do want to attack them. It's hard enough to protect the empire in Egypt. They're going to protect it outside Egypt. And in fact, it says in Josephus, and it says in Sefer HaYashar, and in other sources, that when the Jews took Yaakov Avinu up to Canaan, there were massive wars. And the Pasuk mentions it in passing, that when Yosef went up, they took along chariots and horsemen. Now, why did they take along chariots and horsemen? They took along tanks, they took along artillery, they took along a huge force, and so now we can understand a little bit better why Pharaoh is reluctant and says, you're not leaving. And when they actually did leave, they took on a whole entourage. And in fact, our tradition is they had a massive war en route to Canaan. They were attacked. So when Yaakov makes Yosef promise, so that gives tremendous leverage. Yosef tells Pharaoh, you know, I promised my father, I can't go. The verse adds a word. When Pharaoh gives his approval, Pharaoh says, go bury your father as he made you promise. Why does he add that word, as he made you promise? So our sages say that word indicates that Pharaoh would not have conceded otherwise. The conversation began and Pharaoh said no. And Yosef sent advisors and other people to try, and Pharaoh repeatedly said no. And finally Yosef came to Pharaoh and said, you know, I promised my father I would take him up. And Pharaoh says, so? And so Yosef says, well, I think you want me to keep my promises. And Yosef is hinting to Pharaoh, because when Yosef was interviewed by Pharaoh, they had a custom in Egypt that you walked up the steps to the throne, and every language you knew, you could ascend another step. And the Egyptians held that only Pharaoh knew so many languages to allow him to sit on the throne. Well, when Yosef reached the top step, he had learned all these languages in prison. And when he reached the top step, so Pharaoh said, you are a very impressive young man. And Yosef leans forward and says, but isn't there another language? Why isn't there another step? So he tries talking to Pharaoh in Hebrew, and Pharaoh does not know Hebrew. And then Pharaoh tells him, promise me you'll never tell anyone that you know more languages than I do. Technically, that's against the Egyptian law, that Pharaoh should remain king when there's someone out there who knows more than him. So Yosef promises. Well, now Pharaoh is telling Yosef, so what if you promised? And Yosef says, no, 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 you want me to keep my promises, right? Pharaoh says, you're 100% right. You go up and bury your father just as you promised. We have to keep promises in this life, right? So that's a tradition we have. That's why Pharaoh adds that word. Yaakov becomes ill, and Ephraim is always there learning by him. So he comes back and tells Yosef that grandpa is sick, and Yosef comes to visit him. He takes his children, Menashe and Ephraim. Now, why was Yosef so far away from Yaakov? One of the commentaries says that Yosef kept a distance from Yaakov so that Yaakov wouldn't be able to ask him about whatever happened all those years you were lost. The literal understanding is that Yosef had to be in the capital. He was running the country. And the family wanted to be far away in Goshen so they could have privacy and have their own educational system. So he brings Menashe and Ephraim with him. And Yaakov is told that Yosef has come. And Yaakov strengthens himself to sit up in bed. Our sages say from Yaakov, we learn that even a parent must respect authority. If their son is the king, you sit up in honor of the king. And sometimes you feel like, what's he worth? He's just the president. No. He's the president right now. You got to show him respect. So Yaakov sits up and Yaakov tells Yosef, God blessed me and told me that I would become great nations. And in that, he indicated to me that I would still have two children. Well, I only had one afterwards. So God was telling me that one of my children could be divided and become two tribes. So that's what we're going to do. Your two children that were born before I came to Egypt, before we reunited, Ephraim and Menashe, will count as two tribes. So Yosef gets the double portion as though he's the firstborn son. But which children get that double portion? The children that were born while Yosef was away. Why did the brothers sell him? They said he's trying to usurp us. He's going to be the boss over us. He's going to be the firstborn. We're going to bump him out of his inheritance totally. What ends up happening? Specifically those children that are born during that time that they tried to undo Yosef's rights, they get the double rights. They get the extra rights. And this is a recurring theme in this section of the Torah. It shows up elsewhere too, but here it's a recurring theme that when people try to attain something illegitimately, Hashem shows them how their actions actually develop the result that God has in mind. The brothers sell Yosef to Egypt. That will lead him to the throne. The brothers say, we will ensure he won't get to the throne. He won't be boss over us. Okay, their actions bring him there. Other children that are born, they get to share the lot with Ephraim and Menashe. Yaakov tells Yosef, I know all these years you've had a grudge against me. I asked you a while back, carry me up to Canaan and bury me there. And I know that deep down inside you've been wondering, here I was, your mother died, and we weren't too far away. It was under an hour's journey to take her to Maros HaMachpelah and bury her there. And I'm asking you, don't take me to be buried next to your mom. Take me to be buried next to Leah. I'm telling you, take me back to Maros HaMachpelah and bury me there with my other wife. And I know that deep down inside this has been bothering you. Why didn't I take Rachel, who passed away first, who was my main wife, why didn't I take her to be buried there? Well, let me tell you, God told me to do it. There's a reason there. Yaakov sees Yosef's children and he doesn't see that well. He asks, who are they? And he's really telling Yosef, what's going on here? Where did they come from? And Yosef says, I did things properly. My wife is not just a girl I picked up on the street. I first engaged her to marriage and I waited the year and then I married her. And here, I have the documents to prove it. This is the document I gave her when we got engaged. This is the document I gave her when we got married. And then Yaakov says, okay, bring them here and I will bless them. But first Yaakov wanted to know that they came out of a proper relationship. This wasn't a boyfriend-girlfriend that evolved and then, okay, he's the king, she's the queen. So Yaakov first wants to know, how did this relationship evolve? Yes. If she was the daughter of Dina, then she was born Jewish. No? If we say Osnat was that long-lost daughter of Dina's from Shechem, so she was Jewish without it. Yaakov hugs and kisses Ephraim and Menashe. Now, Ephraim and Menashe are not little boys. How old are they?
That's when they're like 20 and
Right. Ephraim and Manasseh were born before the famine began. When Yaakov is invited to Egypt, Yosef says, the famine's only been here for 2 years, there are five more years left. So they have to be 2 years old at least. And Yaakov lived in Egypt 17 years. So they had to be a minimum of 19 years old at this point. They were both born before the famine.
They're also like, Yosef sends Manasseh, and so he must be a few years old.
So I'm saying, the way they're treated here is, he hugs them, he kisses them. It even seems to say they were on his lap, and that doesn't sound right. It says, Yosef sent them out from between his laps. They're not little boys. They might have been married with their own kids. So it seems like that's a figurative comment. The Targum doesn't take it literally. The Targum says, Yosef sent them from being with him. That me'im birkav doesn't literally mean they were on his lap, because they were 19 years old. That doesn't make sense. It means being close to him. Today we say to be on someone's berech, to be on someone's knee, but that's not how the Targum translates it. So he purposely positions Menasheh to be on Yaakov's right side. And Yaakov extends his right hand to the left side to Ephraim. And he blesses them. He says, Hashem, who my forefathers walked before him, who took care of me till today, the angel who redeemed me from all evil, should bless the children and have my name and my parents' name on them, and they should flourish. V'yidgu larov bekerev haaretz. They should flourish like the fish in the middle of the land. That doesn't seem like it makes sense. So the word v'yidgu could mean to flourish like fish, like dag, or v'yidgu could mean to procreate. They should multiply in the midst of the land. Our sages say the term v'yidgu was purposely used here because fish are unique and that the evil eye can't touch them. Why can the evil eye touch people? Because people are always looking at other people with an evil eye. The evil eye can only touch a person who looks at other people and he wishes he had what they had. If a person looks at other people and desires what they had, then the evil eye can affect them. The whole idea of ayin hara. What is ayin hara? Ayin hara is that a person looks at someone else and says, why does he deserve that and me not? So in heaven, they hear that thought, and they say, maybe he has a claim. Let's reanalyze that. Does he really deserve it? So what the evil eye really does is a person looks at someone else and thinks, why should they have it so good? Why should they be so happy? And then in heaven they say, maybe he has a claim. So if you wouldn't have looked at someone that way, could be in heaven they wouldn't have recalculated the person. So far things are good, they would have let things ride. But when you look at someone that way, so in heaven they recalculate. But that's only if the person himself looks at other people that way. But if a person is like Yosef HaTzadik, where he wouldn't look at his master's wife. He says, that's not mine. Why should I feast my eyes off of her? And so Yosef was so careful not to feast his eyes on his master's wife. So then Yosef and all his descendants, they cannot be hurt by the ayin hara. Yes? They weren't destroyed in the Mabul. Yafeh, I hear. Very nice. Very nice. A very nice thought. Yafeh. So Yosef thinks that maybe his father didn't see correctly because his father can't see well. So he tries to switch his father's hands. And now it's not clear that the youngsters knew what was happening here. They couldn't see above their head if Yaakov was switching his hands or not. So Yosef now tries to switch his father's hands, and he says, you know, the eldest is right here, shouldn't your right hand be there? And Yaakov says, I know, he'll also be great, but the younger one will be greater, and that's why my right hand is on him. And he tells them the Jewish people will bless their children to be like you. The Yekis have a custom every Friday night, we bless our children, Yesimcha Elokim, Kefraim, Vechim, Nasheh. God should make you like Ephraim and Menasheh. then we say the priestly blessing, Yivrecha Hashem Yishmerecha Yershem, etc. So every child comes up and gets that blessing. Friday night before Kiddush, every child gets that blessing. Some have the custom, some do not do this when there are guests. They'll do it at a different part of the meal so as not to make the guests feel bad. Sometimes a guest doesn't have a parent. Sometimes a guest doesn't have children. So there are those who don't do this at that juncture when there are guests present. Our custom was that even on the first day of school, my father would give us that blessing if we were going off to school. And if my father was traveling, if he wouldn't be home for Shabbos, so before he went off to the airport, either the night before, if we wouldn't be up together in the morning, or that morning, my father would bless us, and then he would go off. If we were going off to day camp, so we wouldn't be getting the blessing all summer, or for a week or two, whatever. So then, sleepaway camp, yeah? So we'd get that blessing beforehand, so speak, to make up for the weeks we'd be missing it. So one places his two hands on their head and gives them that blessing. So that's a beautiful Yekish custom. A lot of people adopted the Yekish custom now because people really like it. It's a nice custom. What's unique about Ephraim and Menashe? What's the blessing? Be like Ephraim and Menashe. Why not be like Avram? Be like Yehuda? Be like Shimon? Be like Levi? Be like Moshe? Be like Aaron? There are many giants of Jewish history. So, if I'm not mistaken, Rav Hirsch writes that the uniqueness of Ephraim and Menashe is really the uniqueness of their mother, Osnat. It's the uniqueness to be able to grow up in a Gentile society. It's the uniqueness of having neighbors and acquaintances who do not believe what you believe, who do not function the way you function, they do not pray the way you pray, they don't pray to God, they're praying to other things. And you have to hold on to your own. The blessing of be like Ephraim and Menashe is be successful in your adherence to Torah, even if those who are around you are not. Even if the society you're in challenges the values that I'm trying to bring you up with. That's the blessing of be like Ephraim and Menashe. It's interesting to note that this puts Osnat in a spectacular light. We don't hear Ephraim, Menashe, or Osnat say a sentence in the Torah. We don't know anything about them. And yet, this blessing teaches us that Osnat, Yosef's wife, was one of the most extraordinary women of Jewish history. The brothers were ready to kill her because her father was Hitler. Okay, he wasn't Hitler, he was Shechem. But sometimes people are ready to kill someone because of who their father is. But why? She was a wonderful human being. This concept, there was a story here in Jerusalem, that a shul discovered that one of their members was a ger whose father was an SS man. And people wouldn't let him come to shul. And that is completely against halacha. A person does gir, we don't hold what their father did against them. What did they do? So people let their emotions get the better of them. And the rabbis told them, what are you doing? What did this guy do wrong? What do you have against him? No, why not? What happened? The person, what more could you want of them? So here we see Osnat, her father was the treacherous Shechem, her grandfather was Hamor, vile people, and yet she became one of the finest women of Jewish history. And where did she grow up? In Potiphar's house. She didn't have Yaakov's education, right? Yaakov was scared that Shimon and Levi might bump her off. They'd say, you know, we killed out the whole city of Shechem, can't leave her around. Yaakov says, no, 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 there's nothing wrong with her. And so Yaakov has her raised down in Mitzrayim, and you see what a success that was. She became such a phenomenal woman. Okay, she married well, but she became a phenomenal woman. Yaakov tells Yosef, I'm giving you the city of Shechem, because I conquered it from the Amori with my sword and my bow. So if we're going with the Medrash that says that after the story of Shechem, the people came to war against them. They said, what'd you do killing out a whole town? So then that's literal. The Targum says it means with my prayer, with my supplications. That's why we were entitled to Shechem. Technically, we should have lost Shechem. The nations weren't happy with us after what Shimon and Levi did. But my prayer is what Hashem accepted and allowed us to have Shechem, so I'm entitling you to that, and that's what Yosef received. And now we're up to Revi, the great blessings of Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov is at the end of his days. Our sages say we learn from Yaakov that a person should not give rebuke, because if you give rebuke, you'll have to repeat it and say it again and again. You rebuke at the right time. And Yaakov knew the right time to rebuke his children was before he passed away. It's the final moments. They know that he's saying it for their benefit. There's nothing personal in it. And he tells them, come, I want to tell you what's waiting for the Jewish people. He wants to reveal to them when the Messiah is going to come, and Hashem leaves him. So when Hashem leaves him, he says, maybe some of you are not monotheists. What's going on here? Why wouldn't Hashem let me reveal to you the future? So the children look at him in shock, and they all say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Our father Yisrael, listen, we believe in the same God as you. And Yaakov whispers, Baruch Shem Kivod, etc., or Yehei Shmei Rabbah, etc. And the Medrash says every day when we declare Shema Yisrael, one level of interpretation is that we're making that declaration toward heaven. Yaakov Avinu, look, we're still keeping that monotheism that you taught us. Shema Yisrael, we're saying to Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov whispered the Baruch Shem, and it's not recorded in Torah, so we also whisper the Baruch Shem. Yaakov looks at them and says, maybe there's a chet. Maybe you guys transgressed my mistake. They said, look at the letters of all our names. The letters do not include the letter chet or tet. None of the tribes have those letters. Yaakov says, Ribbono Shel, none of my children have chet. The Ribbono Shel answers, and none of them have the letters ketz. You want to reveal to them the future? The Kates, when the end of time, when the Mashiach's going to come, well, none of their names include the letters Kuf or Tzadi. Figure it out, guys. Go through it. Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Figure it out. You'll see. Back to our Parsha. So Yaakov calls them, gather. I want to tell you what's coming. Reuven, you were first. You were my first strength. And you rushed. You should have had more than everyone else. You should have had the priesthood. You should have had the kingship, and you lost it all, because Pasuk Daled, Pachas Kamayim, you were swift as water, just as water rushes in a river. The whole word river, Nahar, comes from the word Noher, to charge forward, right? You were swift as water, Al Totar, and that's why you won't have more than all the other brothers, even though you were the firstborn, and you should have had the kingship and the priesthood, you won't have that. Kialita mishkeve avicha, because you interfered in the matters of my bed. As chilalta yitzui ala, you desecrated the beds I slept on. So you got involved in areas you shouldn't have gotten involved in, even though you meant well. You lost by it. Learn from it. You're not supposed to get involved. You're not supposed to be so quick. Look at where it got you. Our sages say, Yaakov rebukes Reuven at this juncture. He says, all my life, I didn't tell you anything because I was scared you'd leave me and join Esav. But now it's over. So now I'm going to tell you. He was scared that Reuven would leave him and join Esav. Our sages are teaching us what happens when you rebuke someone. Our sages are teaching us that even great people like Reuven, they take it personally, and you have no way of anticipating where the chips will land. The idea of giving someone a little bit of tochach, I'm just rebuking them a little bit, I'm just going to mention how it should be better, you don't know where that'll drive them. So yet, Reuven, he says, I didn't rebuke you until now, even though what you did was wrong. Reshit Oni. He says to Reuven, you were my first strength. Our sages say there's an allusion here to the idea that Yaakov never spilled his seed. This was the first drop that Yaakov emitted. And we read this and we can see two messages from this. One person will walk away and say, You see, Yaakov never had any, he never woke up in the middle of the night realizing that any mission happened unintentionally. Look, okay, we should all be that way. Well, maybe. It's a noble thing to aspire to, but the flip side is that when the Torah tells us that Yaakov was unique in this, the Torah is telling us that it's a superb level, and that most people, even great people, don't attain that level. A person shouldn't be frustrated with himself. You look at people who are exceptional, every person has an area where they will try to excel. And you look at someone and you say, the Torah tells us how exceptional he was in this. He was beyond the age of 60 when he got married, and he never lost a drop of seed. Okay, and you see the Torah mentions it as the exception, not the rule. A normal person, even if they're clean in their thoughts and clean in their actions and clean in what they look at, will have an emission every so often, and that's normal. If that happens, that's normal, and a person doesn't have to be frustrated with it. That happens. We're up to Shimon. Shimon, he says, you and Levi are achim, good brothers, aren't you? Good brothers for your sister. You're willing to be filled with zeal to fight on behalf of Dina. But where was that brotherly love on behalf of Yosef? You're willing to sell him down to Egypt for prostitution? You who fought prostitution, you who were willing to kill a whole city, but your weapons are stolen goods. You're using weapons that are not a part of our family. What were you doing fighting Shechem? Bisodam al tavo nafshi. My soul was not a part of their secret. Bikalam al techad kivodi. When they gathered, my honor wasn't there. In their anger, they killed the man. They killed all the people of Shechem. They didn't ask me. And it was their desire that allowed them to uproot the walls of the city. Or uproot Shor Yosef, who is referenced as the ox. So cursed is their anger. He doesn't curse them. He curses the trait. Cursed is their anger. It is so brazen. Cursed is their wrath, because it is so tough. I will scatter them in Jacob, I will scatter them in Israel, because anger is very important. Without anger, people are too docile, and things don't get done. But anger has to be used in the right measure. You take 50 angry people, you put them together in a room, you'll have destruction. You take 50 angry people, you scatter them, and you put one on each committee, you will have productivity. Because the committee will tone down the anger, and the anger will spurn the committee to work. So when Yaakov says, I will scatter them in Israel, what Yaakov is saying is, you guys are like a very sharp spice. You're good if you're spread out throughout the food that's being cooked. But if you're all gathered together, go eat a spoonful of cinnamon. You know, people die from that. But cinnamon sprinkled over a whole cholent, a kugel, okay, that's delicious. So that's why he says, I'll scatter you. Our sages say, when he said, I am not a part of their secret, so that he's saying, there will be a time when the tribe of Shimon unites, and they all go in cahoots to be promiscuous. When the Midianites come, and the Jews are on the verge of entering the land of Israel, and the tribe of Shimon unites with their leader, and they go with the girls of Midian, including their leader. So, Shimon, you fought against that, right? But look at where your tribe will get to. I'm not a part of it. Yaakov says, I don't want to have anything to do with that secret. Remember, the head of the tribe came to Moshe, and he said, Moshe, you took a Midianite girl, why can't I? And then he publicly took her on the roof. He publicly took her on a tent, I'm sorry, and went to be promiscuous with her. So when the Pasuk records who he was, it says, V'shem Ish Israel Hamuke, the name of the Jew who was killed, Zimri ben Salu Nisi Veitav LaShimoni. It says, Zimri, the son of Salu from the tribe of Shimon, but it doesn't say the son of Yaakov. Yaakov says, Ribon Shom, don't mention me there. And when Bikhalam, when you guys gather against Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't want my honor to be a part of it. And that's why Korach, who gathers, he's from the tribe of Levi, against Moshe, it says, Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kehat ben Levi. It doesn't say ben Yaakov. Why did it go up that far? Yaakov begged, Ribon Shom, I don't want to have a part in it. Now, there, it seems like there's a deeper meaning here. That Yaakov is saying it's your weakness that will develop those traits in your tribe. It's not my weakness. I don't deserve to be mentioned when you have those downfalls. You do deserve to be mentioned. And in this stern warning, what Yaakov is revealing to them is, you guys have to work on this because you're the fathers of a tribe. And that means that the tribe will evolve with your weakness. Levi, you went ahead and charged a city. You didn't talk to me. You will see how your people will charge the leader of the Jewish people. Your descendants, Korach, will still take that very trait and bring about the greatest threat to the Jewish people, the threat of usurping Moshe and the truth of the Torah. Shimon, you're so zealous, you're willing to fight without talking to me. You will see your descendants will also be willing to fight. The tribe of Shimon will unite around their leader, ready to fight the rest of the Jewish people, ready to fight Moshe, but fight for the wrong things. You realize you have to work on it. When Yaakov is giving them this criticism on his last day, he's saying, this is what you guys have to work on. Cursed is their anger. How careful was Yaakov not to curse them? Pasuk Chet. Yehuda starts taking steps back. He's scared. What's his dad going to tell him? So, Yehuda. Ata. You, Yehuda, don't go away. You're not like them. You are going to lead the Jewish people. Yehuda is the only one we see in the Torah did an overt tshuva. We don't see the overt tshuva. We don't see the tshuva of Reuven, Shimon, or Levi. When Yehuda stands publicly and says, I did it, I am wrong, Tamar is right, that's when Yehuda does tshuva. So then Yehuda, and this is the hallmark of a leader, when a leader stands up for what's right, and he's not concerned about the repercussions of standing up for what's right, that's when he's a real leader. And that's when he stands to lose, but that's when he really gains. When he stands up and says, I'm sorry, this is wrong. And here Yehuda said it about himself. Yehuda said, I was wrong. So Yehuda, your brothers will thank you. Yehuda, you will grab the enemy by the neck. When you come to the war, the enemy will start fleeing and you'll grab him by the neck. And so the rest of the family will bow down to you. You will be the leader of the Jewish people. He says, the sons of your father, because there are multiple wives, so it has to be the sons of the father, they'll all bow to you. Yehuda, you are Gur Aryeh. You'll be like a young lion, and then you'll be a mature lion. Just as King David begins under King Saul's reign, and ultimately he becomes the mature lion. Miteref b'ni alita. I suspected you were the one who destroyed Yosef. When I said, Taruf, Toraf, Yosef, I meant Yehuda must have killed him. Miteref, but from that, which I thought you killed him, Beni Alita, no you didn't. You stayed away from it. When Tamar was about to be killed, thrown into the fire, you got up and said, no, I did it, don't let her die. So from that destruction of Yosef or Tamar, you distance yourself. And in that merit, you will have the strength of a lion to crouch, to leap, to when you want to settle, no one will get you to rise. You will take the throne. The staff will not leave the tribe of Yehuda. And that's what Nachmanides writes, that's why the Hasmonean kingdom was doomed. And that's why they were punished. That's why they died. That's why they were rebelled against. That's why they were ultimately annihilated. Because they transgressed this pasuk. The pasuk says the leadership comes from Yehuda. Umchokek mi ben raglav. And the ones who write the laws, those are the great sages who know how to give halachic ruling. Our sages say there is a greater tendency to have big poskim from Yehuda. Umchokek mi ben raglav. Ad ki avo shiloh. And we discussed this pasuk at length. There's a big discussion among the commentaries. What does that mean, Ad ki avo Shiloh? Our tradition is, until who's coming to Shiloh? Mashiach. V'lo yikeha tamim, and then the nations will gather around him. That's Mashiach ben David. But we learned this pasuk at length in Nachmanides' debate. This pasuk was focused on in the Drashot Aran. This pasuk was focused on, and in Torat Hashem Tmimah, this pasuk was focused on. This has been a central pasuk which other religions wanted to say is a reference to their beliefs, and we discussed the logical proofs of why it does not mean what they're suggesting it means. What it does mean, well, that's also a discussion, what it does mean. What does it mean? Ad ki yavo Shiloh, till he comes to Shiloh. Who's coming to Shiloh? But the nations will have to gather around he who comes to Shiloh. Osiri lagefen iro. You guys wanted to go with the text. I'm doing what you asked for, yes? Yeah? Still with that? Okay. The land of Judah will flourish with wine like a river. Osri, he will bind, the people of Yehuda will bind Lagefen to the grapevine, Iro, the young donkey, Velasoreka, Beni Atono, and from a sorek, from a branch of one grapevine, will carry that a young donkey, Beni Atono, which is a way of saying that ordinarily you tie your cattle to a corral or something. They will have so many grapevines that they will tie their cattle to the grapes, to the grapevine, to the soreka, to a shoot of a grapevine. Ki beis bayayin levusho, they have so much wine, they use it for laundry. Ki beis bayayin levusho, they'll use wine to cleanse their clothing. Uvedam anavim suto, and the blood of grapes will also be used for their garments. So again, blood of grapes means wine, right? It's another metaphor. The idea is that the land of Yehuda will be filled with wine. Chachlili einayim miyayin. Their eyes will go red from having so much wine. Ulven shinayim mechalav, and they'll have white teeth because they'll have so much milk. That's the end of Yehuda's blessing. Our sages say this pasuk teaches us something. Uleven shinayim mechalav, showing the white of your teeth, is more important than offering someone a glass of milk. People need your smile more than they need your food. We sometimes think we help someone because we've given them charity. The Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch says the spirit with which you give the charity can be more important than the actual charity. And this is true in many mitzvot between man and his fellow man. It's true in the laws of Kibud Amem as well. It says you have a kid who tells his father, "Dad, you got to help me with the workload." And his father helps him and he works hard, but he does it respectfully. He says, "I'm sorry, but you know, we have so many mouths to feed and you're welcome and we're going to work together, but I need your help." And his father works with him. And even though his father's working hard, the manner in which he does it makes it respectful for the father. He knows that if his father isn't working, his father might collapse. His father might be drafted into the army and die there. So he has his father work, but it's for his father's own benefit. That's Kibud Avim. Then you have a kid whose father is sitting at home and he feeds him and he gives him everything he needs and he's sitting on an armchair. But every time he brings him the food, he says, "You can masticate and take this down." He treats him like a dog. Chew, old man, chew. If he treats him like a dog, even though he's giving him the best of foods, that's not Kibud Avim. So the Talmud says, and the Shulchan Aruch says, that in many mitzvot between man and his fellow man, the manner in which we do it carries a tremendous weight. So, leven shinayim mechalav, the Talmud says, showing the white of your teeth, giving someone a smile is more precious than giving milk. The Talmud says, you smile at someone, it's as though you've given them to eat and drink. Because people walk around and they are yearning for someone to smile at them. People are yearning for someone to give them that feeling that they're worthwhile, that they're worth something. My wife had just given birth last year. And I was taking the kids to Gan, and it was the middle of the winter, and I was rushing. And I dropped off one child in school, and we were running up to catch the next bus to take us to the next child's gun. And we're getting drenched in the rain. And I'm running with a kid and I see the bus coming. And the driver sees me 5 steps away from the stop. And had he stopped, then by the time he braked to a halt, I would have been at the stop. But instead, he sees me getting drenched with a little child and he points, "You're not at the stop," and keeps driving. And I knew this driver. This was a driver who was always nasty. And I have to walk. I knew the next bus would be a half hour. It wasn't worth standing in the rain with the child. So we walked those 10, 15 minutes in the rain. And the whole way I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, I know that driver. This is a small town we live in. I'm going to see him again. And I walk the kid to gun. And I bring the child to gun. And now I'm going to be late. And I'm standing there drenched and cold. And I'm waiting for the next bus. And just my luck, he finishes his route, and now he's back on the next route, and he's the driver of the next bus. So I'm standing at the bus stop, and I see him approaching. Now I have quite a few things I want to tell that man. The door opens, I climb up, and I tell myself, "You're not going to do this, you're not going to do this." I paid my fare and went and sat down and didn't say a word. He didn't bother apologizing, and I didn't say a word. I forced myself not to say anything. And I kept arguing with myself. I kept saying, "You know, you're upset at the guy, but what are you going to accomplish?" And I had a real internal struggle. I really wanted to file a complaint. And this guy was always nasty as a driver. And I worked on myself. It was a lot of work. Until 2 or 3 weeks later, I see him coming to the stop and I'm standing there with the kids. And the guy never smiled. The guy always barked at everyone who boarded the bus. And as he's approaching the stop, the door opens, and I tell the little kid who has no clue what's going on, I say to them, "This is the nice driver we always wait to take us. This is our favorite driver." And I say it looking down to the child so the driver can hear it. And for the first time in my life, I see this driver who I'd seen barking for months. I see him smile. Now, I had to force myself to say that sentence. I looked at the child and I said, "That's our favorite driver, right?" And as we board the bus, I tell him, "How are you? Good morning." Now, this is a man who I said good morning to for months, and I never got so much as a response, just a scowl. Now I get a smile. "I'm doing well. How are you?" Suddenly, we have a relationship. Levin shinaim mechalav. Everyone is yearning for that treatment. Even the guy who is rough with us. Even the guy who is tough with us. I had a meeting and I checked with the place where we were supposed to meet, the coffee shop. They were supposed to be open till 8:39. I show up at 8 and the person behind the counter tells me, "I'm sorry, we're closing now." I said, "You know, I called. They told me you guys are open till 8:39. And the person says, "I'm working here for a year. We're never open till 8:39. So I was tempted to argue and tell the person, "You know, I've been in this place since they opened their doors. And they've always been open till 8:39. But I didn't say a word. I looked at the person I was supposed to meet and I said, "No, maybe we'll go somewhere else." We started thinking over our options. I looked at the guy behind the counter and smiled and said, "You know what? I see you're cleaning up. If we sit in the corner and don't make a mess, is it okay if we stay for a half hour? I was planning for a half hour meeting anyways." And the person says, "Sure." And with that, we concluded the whole ordeal. The place was really open till 8:30. I don't know why they didn't want us to sit down. But you fight, you get one response. You show the white of your teeth. Ulevin shinaim. The Talmud says, this pasuk teaches us, people are yearning for your smile more than they're yearning for your milk. People need that. They want that. That's so important to them. Levin shinaim mechalav. The Talmud says, showing them the white of your teeth is more precious than giving them a glass of milk. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Zevulun. He turns to the tribe of Zevulun and he tells them, Lechof yamim yishkon. You will settle at the shores. Vehu lechof oniyot v'yachatol tzidon. You will live with ships at the harbor. V'yachato al tzidon. And the end of your domain will be by the city of Tzidon all the way to the north. So, in his blessing, he encompasses what Yisachar will be all about. The tribe of Yisachar will be partners with Zevulun, and Zevulun will fund them in their business. They will be merchants. They'll live by the sea and they'll fund their brother Yisachar. This concept of Yisachar Zevulun shows up in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam, who is so famous for saying that people who learn Torah shouldn't be a burden on the masses, the Rambam himself had this deal with his brother. His brother funded him. And this is quoted in the Talmud. It says that Hillel learned all his Torah in poverty. And then when he became a very big rabbi, his brother, who was a big businessman, came and said, "You have so much Torah and I never learned too much, so I'll make you a deal. I'll give you $1 million, you give me half your Torah." Hillel says, "All the years I've been learning in poverty, now you come, now, no, forget it." The Talmud says it couldn't work. You can't buy retroactively someone else's Talmud. You can partner with someone as they go through the process. And that's what's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. We actually have contracts like this called Yisachar Zvulun, where people say, "We'll be partners. I'll give you X amount from my profits, and you'll give me a portion of your learning." That's called the Yisachar Zvulun deal. And that's what Zvulun is described as, the businessman. Yisachar Chamor Garem. Yisachar is like a donkey that has big bones that could carry a large load, and that's the idea that Yisachar can carry the Torah. You have to be able to carry the weight. Rovetz ben Amishpatayim. He's like a donkey that travels day and night, and he never rests at home. He's always traveling. Those who want to learn Torah have to be prepared to invest day and night. It's like Rovetz ben Amishpatayim. On the borders is where he settles down. Yeah, when a donkey's traveling nonstop, so he never gets to settle at home. That's the idea of one who's learning Torah. You go to this yeshiva, you finish everything you could get from there, you go on to the next yeshiva. You learn by this rabbi, you get everything you can out of him, you go on to the next rabbi. Gentlemen, there's a rule, and this is a rule which, if you hold on to this, you will build different lives. Those who stay connected to yeshiva, those who know they must continue going to a shir and learning every night, those are the people who build their lives. People leave Machon Meir and feel like I graduated. Those are the people who have grave difficulties because their Judaism is up to the level they reached after a year at Machon Meir or 2 years at Machon Meir. And you're very limited in what you can accomplish in a year or two. It is those that hold on to it and keep going and keep coming back. You know, the Chafetz Chaim writes that if a person is working all day long, he says, "I got to work, I got to make a living, I got to support a family, but I'm working so that at the end of the day I'll have that hour of learning Torah." And then he goes to a shir at the end of the day, he learns that hour, it's as though he learned the whole day. Because he worked the whole day in order to learn that hour. And that's how we have to develop our lives. It has to be a constant in the life we live. We're looking for the system that will instill Torah in our lives. A friend of mine just lost a business, $1 million. Mamash, $1 million, $900,000+ that they invested and worked, and the business just couldn't take off. So the guy is a little bit stunned. Okay, he didn't have the $1 million to lose. He's sort of knocked off his feet. And he's not sure what to do with his life. What they call in between jobs, which is a nicer way than saying, he doesn't have a job right now. But it's true, because he's young. He has to build his life. And Bezrat Hashem, he will succeed. So I spoke to him today, and I said, "What are you doing with your life? Where are you going?" You know, he's got to pick up his pieces. It's been a few months now that he hasn't done anything to make a living. So he says to me, "I'm doing daf yomi." And he was serious. And his point was, "I'm in a system. I've gotten into a system. I'm learning a daf every day, and I'm slowly picking myself up, and I'm moving forward. And the first step is I'm getting back into Torah. And now I'm going to figure out how I'm going to make a living and what my next step is." And I was so impressed by the answer. He said, "I've stuck to it already for quite a while, and that's step one." Okay, we got to figure out step two and step three. Yisachar Chamor Garem. He doesn't get to rest too much because he's trying to accomplish in Torah. Vayal Menucha Kitov. And so he sees that he was given a portion where technically he could rest, because he's given a good portion, he has good land. And that his land is pleasant. But he doesn't say, "It would really be nice to take a break. Let me sit back and enjoy the sunshine." No, he shifts his shoulder and says, "I can carry more weight." And so he ends up being taxed because he is the public servant. And that's the question a person has to ask himself. A person comes home at night, he could be with his wife, he could be with his kids, he could eat dinner, and then what? He can say, now let me sit back and enjoy, let me take a break, I worked all day. Or he can say, I got to accomplish. I'm going to go to a shir, I'm going to go to daf yomi, I'm going to go learn something. And then when I come at the end of the week, I'm going to have what to give my kids. Vayek shichmo lisbol. The pasuk begins and says, "Vayar minucha kitov." Everyone knows that it's a great idea to sit back. Let me sit down and have a cup of tea with my wife. Let's sit down for 2 hours and schmooze. Is it necessary? We had dinner together. We have times together. Once a week we go out on a date. We have our times together. Do I need to enjoy life every day? Am I really going to enjoy life every day? No. Vayetchich molis body shifts his shoulder and says, "I can carry more weight. I can stick more into my day. I could learn more in my day." What ends up happening if you really know Torah? You become a public servant. And that means there's work. By Hilema Soved, he's the continuously taxed worker. Now, when I got smicha, sort of, Pesach Zatzal told me the following story. He told me two stories. Number one, his father-in-law was deathly ill. His pulse kept going really low. And he didn't have too much strength. And he was lying in the other room, and his daughter heard the phone ring, so she rushed to answer it. And someone called and said, I want to ask the rabbi a question. So she said, you know, he's weak, he's resting, and suddenly she feels a tap on her shoulder. She turns around, and she sees her father totally white, and he signals, give me the phone. And he answers the shayla. And after she hangs up the phone, he says to her, never do that again. Someone calls with a shayla, that's what I'm here for. So long as I can answer, I have to answer. That was the first story Rav Pesin told me. The second story he told me was about two rabbis who were being executed by the Romans. And one rabbi turned to the other and said, why do we deserve this? What did we do? We taught Torah our whole life. And the second rabbi said to the first rabbi, tell me, did you once come home and have lunch and eat a little bit more than you should have eaten? And because you ate more, you had to go to sleep because you were tired, because you ate too much. And because you went to sleep, people came to ask you a halachic question and you weren't available for them. He said, you should know you're held accountable for that too. So those are the two stories. That was like the welcoming committee. Welcome to having smicha. You have a responsibility. Now go deal. Yisachar says, I got to take the load. Vayhi lemasoved. The pasuk says, he becomes a tax social servant. It's not easy. It's a responsibility, but it's a good responsibility. Pasuk tetzayin. Dan yadina moka achad shiftei Yisrael. We just learned about this last night. Dan will judge the people like achad, like the singular one of the tribes, and that is a reference to Hashem himself, that the tribe of Dan will have the greatest leader, the greatest judge, that is Samson. Yidan achash alei derech. The tribe of Dan will be like the serpent. What's unique about snakes? They don't travel in packs. They're one-man show, one snake. Each snake takes on its enemies. So too, Samson was a one-man show. The snake is, he's unpredictable. That's the idea of Samson. Hanoshechi kevesus, the snake bites the heel of the horse. The horse jumps and throws off the rider. What did Samson do? Pulled down the pillars and the house came crashing down with all the people on it. Lishuatcha kiviti Hashem, but Yaakov prays. He realizes that the Philistines will ultimately take down Samson, gorge out his eyes, torture him. And so Yaakov prays, Hashem, I await your salvation. Help him out. Gad gidud yigudenu. So here we have a play on words. This is a song in the blessing of Yaakov's. The tribe of Gad, they are the gidud. They are the force, the battalion that attacks. And when they... one understanding is that they will turn the enemy away. They will lead the forces and they'll turn the enemy away. Me'asher shemeina lachmo, Asher will have a section of the land which will be fat, it will be filled with oil. Vuyiten ma'adani melech, and they will give the delicious food to the kings because they have so much oil. I want to skip forward. I know we said we'd finish the whole thing. If we have time, we'll get back to conclude the blessing, if you want, on Thursday night. But let's just move forward or drop, because we need to know the end of the parasha. He tells them, I'm going to pass away. Bury me in Israel. take me up to that cave that I bought. He gives him the deed that shows that he bought it from Esav. Yaakov gives them instructions how to stand around his bed. We are taught that the tribes represent forces in the world. Every tribe has a color. Every tribe has a month of the year. Every tribe has a corresponding force in the zodiac. Every tribe has a stone in the breastplate. Every tribe has a specific territory in the land of Israel. Every tribe had a specific talis, a design on their talis, which was different than other tribes. The tribes represent forces within Israel. And each force belongs in a different place. And so Yaakov tells them exactly how he wants them to stand around his bed as they take him up to Israel, which our sages say corresponded exactly to how God had the Jewish people set up when they were traveling in the desert. When Yaakov dies, Yosef throws himself on his father's face, weeps, and kisses him. Our sages say two things. Number one, he waited till Yaakov died. The Mishnah in Tractate Shabbos says, if someone is on the verge of dying, don't touch them. Touching them is like touching a flickering flame. So long as you don't touch the flame, it could continue flickering for a while. You touch it, you try to help it, you put it out. And it's tempting to touch it. Same is with the soul. The soul can be flickering, and touching it can cause it to go out. Yosef awaits till Yaakov completely passes away. Number two, our sages say, that Yaakov never kissed Yosef. Yaakov sensed that Yosef had a specific test in his life, and Yaakov wasn't sure if he stood up to it or not. Our sages say, Vayafozu zoei adav. In Yaakov's blessing, he indicates how Yosef pulled back the bow, he had the arrow on the mark, and then he spread out his hands, he didn't shoot. Our sages say that's an indication to what happened. It's a euphemism for the fact that Yosef was fully prepared and equipped, and physically he was there, ready to be intimate with Potiphar's wife. And then he held himself back, but 10 drops came out. He wasn't intimate with her, but 10 drops came out of him. Our sages say for each drop he lost a tribe. Yosef should have fathered 12 children, which could have been like Ephraim and Manasseh. He only ended up with 2. So Yaakov senses that something is not right. He knows Yosef is tremendous, but he's not sure exactly. You see, Yosef has to prove to him, here are the contracts, I married my wife legally. And Yaakov's still not convinced, and so Yaakov never kisses Yosef in all their relationship. And Yosef, only after Yaakov dies, does he dare throw himself on his father and kiss him. His whole life he sensed that his father wasn't comfortable. Yaakov never asks Yosef, what happened there? Where have you been for 22 years? And why? So we learned that some commentaries say Yosef never gave him the opportunity to do so. Maybe there's another understanding. Maybe, I'm suggesting, maybe Yaakov knew how painful it must be. Maybe Yaakov knew something happened here. The guy's garments were torn and covered with blood. You don't go with a person and say, let's revisit the abuse you underwent 22 years ago, just because you want to know. So Yaakov doesn't ask him. That's my suggestion, that maybe that's why. I didn't find that written anywhere. Yosef has Yaakov mummified. There's a big discussion among the commentaries and in Halacha, what was done here, why it was done here, how it was permissible to do it. They wept Yaakov for 70 days, and then, as we discussed earlier, Paro concedes they can ascend and bury Yaakov in Israel. They must leave their families, their children, their cattle in Goshen. And they go up with a heavy army. When they reach the Marasa Machpelah, so Esav shows up. And Esav says, this is my lot. And Yaakov's children, they're standing there in front of the whole Egyptian army, and they say, I don't know about the whole Egyptian army, but a large contingency of the army, they say, you sold it. And Esav says, no. I sold my rights to the firstborn. I did not sell my rights to my basic inheritance from my father. And the tribes say, yes, you did. We saw the contract, and the contract says you sold your basic rights as well. Now, you have no rights. It's not that you only sold your double portion. You have no rights in the Marasa Machpelah. And Esav says, no, where's the deed? So they say, we left it in Egypt. They tell Naphtali, you're swift, as the blessing says, Naphtali ayala shelucha. You are swift like Ayala, I don't know what animal that is. You run back to Egypt and bring it back. So Naphtali starts charging back to Egypt. Dan had a son called Hushim, who was deaf. So he signals them. He says, what's going on here? And they signal him, that man is not letting us bury Grandpa Yaakov. So Chushim picks up a shovel, and he walks over to Esav and knocks his head off. Kills him on the spot. No discussion. And then the Medrash says that Esav's head landed on Yaakov's stomach. Yaakov opened his eyes and smiled. And then Esav's head rolled into the Maaseh Machpelah. Yaakov was buried there and Esav's head was buried there. There's a famous vort that says that Chushim ben Dan teaches us something. Sometimes we're willing to discuss something. We're willing to hear about something. We're liberal people. We're understanding people. And so we talk. And sometimes the mere fact that you enter conversation is a mistake. You're losing focus. And what Chushim ben Dan does is he says, there's no conversation here. This is ours. Yaakov has to be buried and he has no right standing in our way. And he ends the story on the spot. And sometimes you have to be able to do that. We sometimes look at people who are so simple and blunt. We look at them as though they're weak. And sometimes they're very strong. The ability to say, I have nothing to hear from you. This is right. This is what I'm doing. And you're not going to confuse me. I'm not interested. That's a strength. It's not only a weakness. The brothers see that Yaakov's dead. And they're concerned that now what's Yosef going to do to us now that Yaakov's not around? So they send word to Yosef and they say, your dad left a message for you. He said, please tell Yosef, please forgive what your brothers did so wrong to you. Please forgive them because they treated you harshly and improperly. Please, the brothers say, we ask you should forgive us. Now why do the brothers do this? Because they see on their way back, Yosef goes to visit that pit where he was thrown in. And he makes a blessing. Baruch she'asalines b'makom hazeh. They see him eyeing that pit. They say, what's going on here? Our sages say, from this we learn that you're allowed to lie for the sake of peace. The brothers wanted to ensure that a civil war wouldn't erupt between them and Yosef. So they lied. They said, your father said to tell you. Yosef knows it's a lie. Yosef says, dad didn't know till the day he died what happened here. He didn't say such a thing, but he doesn't tell the brothers that. Yosef starts crying. And the brothers throw themselves down before him and they say, we're here by your servants. And Yosef says, don't be scared. What do you think? I'm instead of God? I can decide. I'm going to harm you. God doesn't want to harm you. Look, if all of you couldn't extinguish one candle, me, I'm going to be able to do anything to you? No. This was all God's doing, how I became king here. And with that, Yosef makes a real peace with the brothers. He says, I'll take care of you. He comforts them. He takes the time to talk to them till they are fully comforted. And the book of Bereishis ends with peace between Yosef and his brothers. Our sages say that the peace was not complete because the brothers never apologized. The brothers said, your father said, forgive them. Your father says, please understand they did wrong. They never came forward and said, we say we did wrong and we're sorry. And so although the brothers unite with Yosef, there's something missing because they never really said they were sorry. They hid behind a story to regain the peace. And Yosef says, we'll have peace. But they never actually said they were sorry. And that's why this stain will continue with us to the point of Yom Kippur, as we will discuss.